This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, the American character in times of crisis. Historian David Kennedy has measured the breadth and depth of American perseverance during the Great Depression and World War II. He says America is up to the challenge of the first war of the 21st century. First, the mounting questions about the air and water quality in Lower Manhattan. Among the many things shattered by the September 11th attacks has been New Yorkers' peace of mind about the environmental safety of the area around the rubble of the World Trade Center. Special coverage correspondent Jill Kaufman reports.
Hello. You have reached the Mount Sinai Center for Occupational and Environmental Medicine information line. If you have questions about health-related concerns as a result of the World Trade Center tragedy,
since September 11th, hotlines like this one at Mount Sinai School of Medicine have been fielding calls from people who live and work in New York City, especially in Lower Manhattan. If you've been anywhere in the vicinity of downtown since the terrorist attacks, you know about the smell still in the air. It's a lot like burning rubber. Its strength and direction change daily, sometimes hourly. The smell sticks to your clothes. And no matter how much reassuring there is from the Environmental Protection Agency and other agencies sampling the air, water, and dust in the area, there's a lot of concern the odor is more than just offensive. The EPA has set up about 20 stationary air monitoring stations. Other monitoring stations measure fine particle matter. Over the past 6 weeks, the agency has taken thousands of samples at Ground Zero, on Staten Island, and in New Jersey, where debris from the collapse is being taken. Generally, the samples indicate that residents and people who work in Lower Manhattan are not subject to any significant risk from what they're breathing, at least for now. Bill Majinski is the acting regional administrator for the EPA in New York City.
We're there for the long term. We're not just going to be monitoring for several weeks after the disaster. And we're also, when we apply standards, we're looking at, in some cases, exposures that are acceptable or not acceptable over a 30-year period, and we're trying to bring them back to a shorter duration period to try to make those types of judgment calls. So we're not just looking at a single instant in time. We're looking at a longer range period of time so that we can continue to advise people. And we understand that the site conditions change.
When you get closer to the site, the dust does contain more asbestos. But air actually acts as a diluter. Bill Majinski says you should think of asbestos as if it were sugar. If you were to keep adding water, eventually you're going to dilute the sugar until you can't taste it.
Air can do that too, and as the plume moves, it gets dilute as time goes on. So when you go right at the site, right at the boot level, you'll get a certain reading, and further back from the site in the same plume, you should get a lower reading, and generally would get a lower reading.
From the beginning, rescue workers, construction crews, and other people working at Ground Zero have been more at risk because of their proximity to smoke. This has been acknowledged by the EPA and by others taking samples. It's no surprise that some of the higher asbestos and benzene levels are right there at the plume. Bruce Lippi has spent a considerable amount of time at Ground Zero, and he says the area is not a toxic waste nightmare. Lippi is a certified industrial hygienist with the International Union of Operating Engineers. He's also part of a hazardous material team. Along with OSHA and other agencies, they have distributed thousands of respirators to workers at the site, but handing them out may not be enough.
There has been a real problem, at least at the World Trade Center site, not so much at the Fresh Krills landfill, but at World Trade Center site, with getting people to wear respiratory protection. My understanding is it has improved, but it was troublesome at first. And I understand that there are people who are complaining of what they're calling the World Trade Center cough now, which I believe is very real because there was enormous amounts of smoke and dust initially. And if you weren't wearing a respirator, it certainly could irritate the lungs and throat.
Even though in the short term the EPA has given the all clear for workers who use protective measures, no one knows for sure what the long-term health effects may be from working or living near this site. That may take years, and public health officials say it would be difficult in a city like New York to assemble a large population study. But Bruce Lippi says there have been some initial efforts to track workers at the site.
There are people who are setting up to follow the workers on site long-term to see if any health effects do develop later on or continue. And I think folks at Mount Sinai are working to set up some sort of registry to track workers long term. And that's very important. That really needs to be done.
Something that needed to be done earlier, Bruce Lippi maintains, was the establishment of a formal safety and health plan for site workers. The official version just went into effect this past Monday.
Consequently, there's been real confusion on the site, and there's been real problems with who is actually enforcing safety and health. OSHA is the agency in the country that's responsible for worker safety and health enforcement. They have not been in enforcement mode. They've been serving as consultants. They've been running air samples, which is important. But the question is, who is responsible?
Ground Zero is not a normal work site where the employer is responsible for the worker's safety and health. Bill Lippi acknowledges it's hard to apply the usual standards. But he says, God forbid this ever happens again. We need to do more for workers up front, not as the situation evolves. Right now, people who have been handling debris and are covered in dust are still wandering past the wash-up stations if they don't feel like using them. I'm Jill Kaufman.
Americans rationed sugar, planted victory gardens, sold pencils on the street, and died fighting for great ideals. No matter what the 20th century threw at America, World War II, the Depression, the country and its leaders endured and prevailed. Are you taking comfort from America's past as you face the war on terrorism? Do Americans still have what it takes to pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and triumph over adversity? You can join our conversation this evening at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is David Kennedy. He's professor of history at Stanford University and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. Good evening, David Kennedy.
Good evening, Tom. Good to be with you.
Very good to have you with us tonight. And also joining us from the studios of Sweet Spot Digital in Vermont is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, David.
Hello, Jack.
David Kennedy, you've looked at the Depression and World War II. You looked at FDR. FDR had his four freedoms, but you chose freedom from fear as the overriding theme of your history of the Depression and World War II. Why that freedom, freedom from fear?
Well, Roosevelt, as you probably know, or your listeners may know, articulated the famous four freedoms in a speech in January 1941, in which he said there were at least these four things that were worth fighting to preserve and enhance in the world: freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. I thought that freedom from fear was probably the most fundamental and encompassing of those four freedoms, so that's why I chose it as the title for the book. I also thought that as much as any single phrase could, that phrase, freedom from fear, summed up the great achievement of the generation that had to live through the Depression and World War II, because they wrestled with their fears and liberated themselves from many of them and made the world a much less fearful place for those who came after them.
David Kennedy, you've written so beautifully and insightfully about the progress that Americans made through those difficult times, about how they moved through fear and shock and even despair to hope and effective response and ultimately victory. What was the process you saw when you looked at these great periods? What were the elements of that turnaround in the national psyche and actual material circumstances?
Well, part of it, I think, was simply psychological, and it flowed not least of all from the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt. Every school child in this country probably is familiar with the most famous sentence from Roosevelt's first inaugural address in March of 1933. It's actually the fifth sentence of the address when he says, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." But the sentence immediately prior to that is in some ways even more remarkable and more worth remembering at this moment, I think. It's the fourth sentence of the address, in which he said, "This great nation shall endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper." Mm. And Roosevelt had the capacity not only to believe that down in his bone marrow, but to communicate that sense of confidence about the future to his fellow Americans. Now, mind you, he said that in March of 1933. Mm. And it took at least another decade until the full promise of that moment was fulfilled, when the country really was free from fear and economically reviving and on its way to prosperity.
David Kennedy, put us there. A lot of people are feeling shaken right now. We feel the terrorist threat, new kinds of threats that many Americans alive today have never felt before or had to deal with before. Put us back in the Depression, and I guess there was a second wave of shock and fear when the World War II started. Help us feel what Americans felt at that time. How serious was it? How overwhelming was it?
Well, first, as you just said, Tom, it's worth remembering that this crisis went on for a long time. From 1929 to 1945, a long trial of the moxie of the American people and the strength of their society. The first crisis, of course, is the great economic collapse of the Depression itself. And though this is not a living memory for very many people yet amongst us, the fact is that in early 1933, as Franklin Roosevelt was about to take office, not simply one in every four workers in the country was unemployed, but because of the peculiar demographics of the workforce at that time, in effect, it meant that one out of every four households in the country had no wage income. Wow. That was a lot of people. It was 13 million people unemployed, 13 million breadwinners suddenly gone unemployed. Many of those were not reemployed for years. My own father went wageless, unemployed, for eight consecutive years, from 1930 to 1938.
That's a long time.
That was a trial of the spirit and of the body, you might say, of a sort that we've been mercifully spared ever since. But we shouldn't underestimate the resilience of that generation that somehow or other found the resources to cope with that. And then, of course, as you remind us, scarcely was the Depression, was the country recovering from the Depression. In fact, it had not fully recovered on the eve of World War II. Unemployment was still at about 15% in 1941. And then here comes this second great catastrophic crisis of the war, which eventually took 405,000 American lives. But again, this country, from a state of almost complete unpreparedness in 1941, rallied itself economically, psychologically, militarily, diplomatically, politically, and won through to complete victory. So these are lessons worth remembering, I think, that we remain, we were at that time, and I think we remain a people of really prodigious resourcefulness.
We're going to dig into that this hour and see how we're feeling these days. But Jack Beattie, I want to bring you into this conversation. Give us a sense of then and now. Are there parallels? How much can we look back to that period for inspiration today?
Well, you know, David begins his magisterial book with an account of a study called Recent Social Trends, a 1,500-page opus produced by the Hoover administration, sort of documenting the American situation in 1933. And to look at that, it's very interesting to see some of the parallels. It was an era of immigration. People were just assimilating to American society. And, of course, we've just gone through one of those with a major language component. There was resistance to that in the Ku Klux Klan, as there has been resistance here. More interestingly, the 1920 census was the first time that the metrics shifted from the country to the city. The city now was the dominant place of where people live demographically. Well, in 2000, the metric shifted again to the suburb, which has a very different political aura than the city and than the sort of communal or, by necessity, collective character of much city life and so on, dispersed in the suburb. And then, interestingly, the gap between country and city, strongly in the Democratic Party, a book about it, about that called The Politics of Provincialism. It was the rural folks in the South against the bosses in the city. Cities, and that shakeout of a polity divided really over cultural issues. Really, we saw the same thing on election night with Bush red and Gore blue. The Gore blue really answering pretty much to the kind of split, you know, the urban centers, the coasts that we saw in the 1920s, and Bush red, the country, the same counties that would have been going through the same business. It was a politics about values and about questions questions of course, the Depression quickly trumped all those and entered a new era of politics. The question is whether this crisis will do the same thing.
Jack Beatty, we're going to come right back and talk about history and where we are now. We're talking about, with David Kennedy, about past instances in the Depression, World War II, of Americans rising to big challenges. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with historian David Kennedy about his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Freedom from Fear, that looks back to the Great Depression and World War II, the great challenges of the 20th century. We're looking there for inspiration for the root of American resources that might help us address this first war of the 21st century. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do Americans still have what it takes to face down a tough enemy? Do we still have the unity, the character, the creativity to win freedom from fear? In his 1937 inaugural address, Franklin Delano Roosevelt made the following comments.
I see millions of families trying to live on income so meager that the pall of family disaster hangs over them day by day. I see millions whose daily lives in city and on farm continue under conditions labeled indecent by a so-called polite society half a century ago. I see millions denied education, recreation, and the opportunity to better the lot of themselves and their children. I see one-third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished. But it is not in despair that I paint that picture for you. I paint it for you in hope, because the nation, seeing and understanding the injustice of it, proposes to paint it out.
FDR in 1937, talking about America seeing its own injustices and proposing to paint them out. David Kennedy, the United States came into World War II out of a period of depression. Now we're coming into a new war out of a period of historic affluence. What does that mean? Does it make a difference in the way that the country faces this new challenge?
Well, I think if anything, it means that we're on balance better prepared now to deal with a crisis of the magnitude and the nature of the one that we're facing. The weakness of this society, economically and otherwise, in the 1930s is really not to be underestimated. And it was among the reasons why when Adolf Hitler made all of his strategic preparations for World War II, mm-hmm. why he virtually never took the United States into account. He thought we were an enfeebled democracy without the political will to muster any kind of resources that would be a threat to him, and without the capacity even to revive our own economy, whereas he had revived the German economy long since. So mm-hmm. if anything, I think that point of comparison should give us some consolation that we are much better prepared today institutionally, economically, financially, and so on to deal with a long-term crisis of the sort we're facing.
Jack Beatty, how do you see the relative strengths and weaknesses of the United States heading into this new conflict?
Well, adversity, you can turn David's thought around a little. I think adversity can put the iron in a man. And there was a lot of that, I think, in the greatest generation. And we haven't had much of that, or at least a lot of Americans haven't. So I think that there is a certain people were used to tough times, is all, I guess what I'm saying. Their horizon, their expectation was, well, this is what life is going to be. My own father worked on the WPA and had to resort to sustenance agriculture in New Hampshire in order to feed his family.
A tough place to follow sustenance agriculture, Jack.
Indeed it is. Indeed it was.
Stony soil.
My mother canned things, and we lived off them. My sisters did. So people with that kind of experience facing the world crisis, it was sort of more of the same. I'm not saying that we're decadent or anything to the kind, but looking at someone like Bob Dole, the psyche there is a very different one from sort of the typical American in the 1990s. And so I think that that generation was sort of, what did President Kennedy say, you know, tempered in war, but they were also tempered in adversity. And
yeah, David Kennedy, what about that? You, when you look back at the texture of that time, you see, yes, a country that was enfeebled by depression, but its people had also learned to live with little and were ready to go to war with not much, I guess.
Well, I take Jack's point. I think the psychology of the so-called greatest generation was indeed tempered by adversity, not only the adversity of the Depression, I might add, but by just the general conditions of life in that historical era, even before 1929. Nevertheless, having said that, I'll concede that point to Jack, but I'm very skeptical of the idea that any generation has a measurably different endowment of courage and resolution and resources of the kind that are necessary in the present crisis. I think we maybe will surprise ourselves in the present day with the depths of our resourcefulness and ingenuity.
I find it strangely encouraging to hear you say that. We've been so bathed in the 90s in the greatest generation mythology, as if they were always strong and always heroic. Did Americans feel so resilient and heroic as they entered the crises that you describe in your book, Freedom from Fear?
Well, again, you know, it's not altogether appropriate, I suppose, to speak ill of the so-called greatest generation.
Well, I don't mean ill, but maybe to find some fellow feeling, some fellow humanity, that they weren't always towering figures at every moment. At least they must have felt their own fear.
They surely did. And in fact, among the reasons why I'm always reluctant to give them the title of the greatest generation without qualification is the fact that a heavy majority of them were deep-dyed isolationists until the 11th hour. It wasn't as if they welcomed the chance to wage battle against their eventual foes in World War II, the Japanese and the Germans. A heavy majority of the country was decidedly isolationist right down to the eve of Pearl Harbor. So they were reluctant warriors, just as we are now reluctant victims of the events of September 11th. And we wish life had gone differently. We wish we didn't have to assume this burden. So did they. It wasn't something they sought out. In fact, they tried rather strenuously to avoid it. But when it was thrust inevitably upon them, they rose to the occasion rather magnificently. And I frankly, as one observer, just don't see any reason why this generation will do any less.
We're talking with David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford University, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his book Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Do Americans still have what it takes to face down a tough enemy, to live through tough times? Karen is on the line. Welcome, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First, I want to say that I agree with what your speakers were just saying, wondering whether my generation, which are the generation that's out there fighting right now, has what it takes, because we have been so pampered, it seems. But my question is, I didn't live through Second World War, but I imagine that in those times, the information that they were getting over the news and on the radio or the newspapers, they weren't getting 24/7 news like we're getting.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe is ignorance bliss? I mean, how can we pick ourselves up and be strong and not be fearful when every time we turn on the TV or read a newspaper, I start to shake?
Karen, stay with us. I want to put that to historian David Kennedy. And it's a great point. David Kennedy, what do you make of that? We live in a bath now of information constantly flowing over us. How does that compare with the way Americans understood and were informed about the problems they faced in the Depression and World War II? What difference do you think that makes?
Well, I think Karen makes a very good point that the world of the media and the world of news coverage is entirely different today from what it was then, not least of all because of the power of television and visual imagery to put us right at the scene of the battle, you might say. But I'm also reminded that during World War II, the War Department heavily censored war news and refused to release until 1943, 2 years into American engagement in the conflict, any photographs of dead American soldiers. In fact, one might recollect that of all the hundreds, if not thousands, of photographs we've seen over the years of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. You will notice that you have never seen a photograph that shows a dead human being or a wounded human being.
Only billowing smoke and big ships.
You see the wounded battleships and the smoke and so on. But the War Department, the Navy Department, censored those kinds of photos because they thought they would be too provocative and too inflammatory. Well, that age is gone forever. Nobody can censor out that kind of imagery today, as all of us who saw the video, the television coverage of the flights into the Twin Towers will carry that image around with us forever. So, yeah, I think this is a new element. I'm not sure how to gauge it. Perhaps, if anything, just to put a positive interpretation on it, maybe it'll make us fighting mad in a way that's salutary.
On the other hand, Jack Beatty, it's not an entirely different situation. There is quite a remarkable blackout on images of U.S. troops' activity in Afghanistan right now.
Yeah, we're only getting what the Pentagon shows of targets, quote unquote, blowing up. And but to get back to Karen's point, there's a way you can look at television as sort of a kind of version of the fifth column in World War II or sabotage, because of course it is the vehicle, it's the instrument that the terrorists use. I mean, they make their point through visual atrocity. And that
the magnifying glass.
It just inevitably, as Karen says, we can't pick ourselves up when we're just recovering from one thing. When along comes the next shock in living color, that's a tough one. It would be as if and FDR didn't have to deal with anything quite like that.
Karen, would you prefer the kind of news blackout that David Kennedy describes from the early 40s?
Well, I don't think that's realistic today. But there are times where I do wish for that, even though I know it couldn't possibly happen. But I do agree that I feel like the news media is just helping the other cause, the terrorists, much more in many ways than helping our own country, and even sometimes giving out ideas to of how they can do things more and how they're getting to us. I don't know how much feedback they get from our media, but I sure think that if they're getting any, it's helping to propel their cause and not ours.
Karen, thanks for your call. David Kennedy, is it just a different element of the times we live in? This is the information age. Maybe it's just inescapable. Maybe it's just something we have to learn how to handle that simply wasn't as much of a factor in the 30s and 40s.
Well, I believe that's right. It is inescapable. I think that's the right word. To me, at least, it would be unthinkable that we would seriously propose that the media stop covering these events or somehow stop showing visual images of them. We just simply have to live with that. I think Jack is also absolutely correct that our adversaries, the terrorists, understand that these images are, to use some military language, a force multiplier. The media is a weapon that they use rather cleverly. But to cut off the media and have us all dwell in utter darkness and ignorance about these events, I think, is absolutely not going to happen.
It is now the air we breathe. We're talking with historian David Kennedy about moments in 20th century American history when Americans walked through great challenge, rose to the challenge, and went on to victory. Do we feel the echo of that? Do we feel the same readiness in ourselves to do that today? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Ron is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Welcome, Ron.
Oh, hello. Good evening. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm extremely pleased to listen to this particular program where instead of talking about anthrax threats and other terrors, we are discussing how we are going to cope with this, actually, and how Americans and we as a country are going to react to this.
We do our best, Ron.
Yes, sir. And I myself, I'm from India. I'm a green card holder, and this is something which is pretty close to my heart. My question to the author is this. Sir, back in the during the World War II, the kind of immigrants who were coming to this country were predominantly Italians, Irish, and there wasn't this level of diversity, and there wasn't this level of spectrum of citizenship and ownership towards this country or allegiance towards this country. At that time, previously, we see so many of these romantic videos about people coming in and seeing the Statue of Liberty and going to Ellis Island.
Sure.
And becoming citizens and so on. Right now, you have a very diverse population. You have the people of all ethnicities here. There are people at various levels of, American citizenship, many illegal immigrants and so on.
And what question do you bring out of that, Ron?
Yeah, my question is how does the author feel that with this diversity of, people, how, we as Americans, quote unquote, are going to react to this? What are his feelings on that, actually?
Ron, we're glad to have that question and to have it from you. David Kennedy, what about it? How do you compare the profile of ethnic diversity then and now, and what difference does it make?
Well, I'd say, first of all, that the in actual numerical terms, the proportion of immigrants or foreign-born people in the United States the census of 1940 was almost exactly what it was in the census of 2000. About 10% of the population was foreign-born then as now. Now, there's a couple of differences, however, between that moment and this. As Ron correctly points out,
yes,
the immigrants of 1940, the eve of World War II, were heavily Southern and Eastern European, Italians, Poles, so on and so forth, whereas today's immigrants come from other parts of the world, what we broadly speaking, I suppose, sometimes call the Third World.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, in their own era, those immigrants from Greece and Bulgaria and Yugoslavia and Hungary and Italy and so on were widely regarded as just as exotic and perhaps ultimately unassimilable as have many recent immigrant groups have been thought to have been considered to be.
So America might have felt itself as diverse a rainbow then as it does now?
I think absolutely. And of course, one of the great achievements of the era of the New Deal in World War II is that a lot of doubts about the assimilability and loyalty and commitment to this society and this country of that earlier immigrant generation were all put to rest. And I dare say we've learned something from that historical lesson. I think the degree of tolerance and acceptance of immigrants today is a baseline much much greater than it was in the 1920s, let's say, or 1930s. This is another count where I'm not deeply worried. I think sure there are anxieties in certain immigrant communities today, especially Muslim communities, about what will be the effect on them if this crisis is protracted. I think those worries are genuine, and we all need to think about them. But on balance, I think this country remains a receptive and deeply tolerant society.
Jack Beatty, apart from the early days when there was concern about attacks on Muslims or folks from Central and South Asia, the diversity does not seem to have been a deeply divisive issue so far in America's response, does it?
No, and our leaders seem to have learned from practice, as David Kennedy said, from practices in earlier wars. I mean, the great indictment of Franklin Roosevelt was he acquiesced or didn't acquiesce. He marshaled a plan to remove the Japanese American citizens from the West Coast to Wyoming mm-hmm. and other places in the rustic beyond. And there were other difficulties with immigrants. And I can't imagine we're going to do anything like that. And also the situation of minority groups. I wonder what David would say about that. He points out in his book that in the 1930s, 4 of 5 African Americans were in the South. Not true today.
Jack, we'll come back to that after a quick break here. We're talking with David Kennedy, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of Freedom from Fear, about how Americans handled 20th century challenges, what it might mean about how they'll handle challenges today. We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can read the first chapter of David Kennedy's book, Freedom from Fear. It's at our website, wbor.org. Click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy about the history of Americans rising to major challenges in the 20th century, specifically in the Great Depression and World War II, and what lessons we can draw from that period of history as we face the first war of the 21st century. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're great, thanks.
Well, I'm 41 years old, and, grew up in the area which we call the tail end of the baby boom.
Okay.
I grew up with the shadow of the Cold War, Vietnam, and recently the Gulf War, and now this. I have little doubt that my generation, the so-called baby boomer generation, has the wherewithal to rise and face this challenge. I mean, it's been evident by looking at all the surge of patriotism that we're rising to the cause. It's it's been very uplifting. Mm-hmm. However, the generation that I think I have a concern with and I would like to send a message to is those who are like the 18 to 25-year-old range, okay? Mm-hmm. If you take a look at the people who are in their early 20s, they are just coming out of college. They are just entering their adult years and being thrust into a recession, this war. And from speaking with them, some of them live in my neighborhood. I live in a suburb called Franklin,
all right,
where a lot of them are 14, 16, 18, and in their early 20s.
And what do you hear?
Well, I hear they're uncomfortable with this. They are unhappy. They're uncertain. And they're
But we're all uncomfortable, unhappy, and uncertain, aren't we, Mark?
Well, we are. But I have a message for them, and I hope they're listening. I want to tell you what my message is, and you give me your opinion on this, okay? I think this is an opportunity to reaffirm the values and principles upon which this country was founded. Going way back to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness did not come about without great sacrifice and conflict.
So you want to remind young people of the fundamentals and in the hope that that gives them strength today. I want to take that, and I thank you for your call, Mark, and give it to David Kennedy. David Kennedy, in the Depression, in World War II, was there concern between generations that one or the other generation might be more capable, more ready to rise to the challenge than others?
Well, first let me say to Mark that it's heartening to hear someone say something good about the much maligned baby boom generation, so I thank him for that. But sure, I mean, I teach a course here at Stanford University on World War II, and I repeatedly remind my students that the young people who went off to fight World War II mm-hmm. were precisely the age of the people sitting in my classroom. It was 18 and 19-year-olds. And any society in a situation where it has to send millions of its young people off to war, I think has the same doubts and fears, whether this young, untested, untried, youthful generation will be up to the task. The World War II generation was, and I think it's far too early for us to conclude that Gen X or Gen Y doesn't have the stuff.
I have to say from my own interactions with teens that I almost see them as less conflicted than baby boomers about responding to a call to war. I see less hesitation, almost more rising to the flag, but I guess it all depends who you talk to. We're talking with historian David Kennedy about the Depression, World War II, and the resources and resourcefulness that Americans showed during that time and how it might apply again today. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Giselle is on the line. Welcome, Giselle.
Yes, good evening, and thank you for your show, which is interesting. I was kind of irritated that there is a comparison between what happens now and what happened during the Second World War. And I lived through that war in France, which mm-hmm. is my home country. I'm mm-hmm. an American now, and mm-hmm. I'm suffering like everybody from what happened and the shock and the horror and the fear and the anguish I share with all of us, all of you and the other Americans.
But you don't think it's comparable, this new war and World War II?
No, I mean, I don't, you know, I lived through one war. My father lived and died, you know, was a victim of both wars. He was wounded in the trenches in 1916, and then he was, so you can imagine whether he was a pacifist. And, I have to restrain from saying I'm against all wars, but I mean I am. I don't see people dying. But the situation, let's leave the pacifist side aside, but the situation here is not, we don't have an enemy. I mean, the Americans in 1939 and 1941, they were hard, you had a hard time deciding because they were not attacked here. I understand it was very hard. And they were very brave and patriotic, and so it was all great. They saved me, you know.
Yes.
I don't forget. But
we don't have quite the same kind of clear-cut enemy today, and not war in the same way. Jack Beatty, what about that? This is a very different kind of war, and thank you, Giselle, for your call. It's a worthy observation here. This is not trenches. This is not armies lined up facing one another. Is it fair for us to be making these comparisons through David Kennedy?
Well, it is a kind of war. Someone has said that the 20th century pioneered war on civilians, strategic bombing and worse, and that the 21st century has begun with war of civilians on civilians. Mm. We're the front line here. We're in a situation a little bit like the British. For a good part of the war, there were three times as many British people killed in England than there were on the battlefields abroad because of the nature of the campaigns and so on. The home front was where the war was being fought. And this is the peculiarity of this current situation. To be sure, we don't have – we're not occupied. We don't have – our freedom isn't impinged the way this woman, Giselle's freedom was by the Wehrmacht and the Gestapo. Mm-hmm. But we feel the presence of the fear in the air constraining
us.
Sure do. Or nothing like what she felt, but it's there. It's a peculiar kind of war for us.
It is. David Kennedy, are you comfortable with people drawing parallels or looking for inspiration from a real old-fashioned war, World War II, as we face this new kind of war?
Well, yeah, I do think the parallels are quite legitimate. And World War II was not quite an old-fashioned war. I think as Jack
Beatty... Yes, only looking back now.
Well, yeah, in hindsight, I think I suppose everything looks old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. But as Jack Beatty has just reminded us, the very phrase home front is a phrase that was essentially coined to describe World War II when civilian populations and the heartlands of belligerent countries were all at risk of coming under attack. And indeed, it's a peculiarity of America's engagement in that war that we were the only major belligerent whose heartland was not seriously at risk after the first attack on Pearl Harbor. But the it was a war on civilians. It was a war that attacked civilian targets and urban centers, cities, industrial complexes. Those were all huge novelties for the people at the time. Air war was a novelty. The heavily mechanized forces that Hitler brought to bear in so-called blitzkrieg tactics, lightning war, fast-moving armor, that was a novelty.
So maybe every war seems new, especially as time seems to accelerate here.
Every war presents its own peculiar problems. That's, I think, the enduring lesson.
David Kennedy, I want to ask you about change. During the Depression under FDR and during World War II and after, the United States went through a lot of change. Do you anticipate that that's going to be required again this time? And do you see the same readiness for change? Were people ready for change, or did they resist it?
Well, I think there are some changes already in train in our country today that we will live with for a long time to come. I think we're going to be reconfiguring our armed forces, for example, in ways to give them more mobility, more capacity to deal with unconventional or so-called asymmetrical attacks. Mm-hmm. I think as a people, we're going to have to learn to live with a certain degree of uncertainty about the future. I think that's going to be a permanent change in our psyche. World War II as well, you know, produced huge changes that no one anticipated at the front end. Nobody could foresee the changes in race relations, the changes in the distribution of the population to the West Coast, for example, the growth of California, which is now the largest state by a factor of two times larger than the second largest state, which is Texas, owes to the great changes that were put in motion by World War II. So some of these changes aren't easy to see.
And yet
the
front end of the process. Maybe they inevitably come.
But they surely come.
David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford University and author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Jack Beatty, final thoughts. David Kennedy stirs a lot at my end. I'm sure yours too.
Yeah, let me give you a paragraph of David Kennedy's. He's talking about the typical American in 1929. He was living better than his parents had ever dreamed of living. He was young and vigorous. Times were good, and the future promised to be still better. He had just cast his first presidential vote in 1928 for Herbert Hoover, the most competent man in America. In that same year, he married a girl 3 years younger than he. She gave up her house to have their first baby. They started to think of buying a house, perhaps in one of the new suburbs. Life was just beginning, and their world was about to come apart.
Wow. And here we are looking at a world that's come apart in Lower Manhattan and come apart in some of our minds. Jack Beatty, thanks so much, as always, for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty is our special coverage news analyst and a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Now, the continuing conversation on our special coverage website at WBUR.org. Night and day, listeners are hitting our website and clicking on forums to pour their hearts into the discussions we start on the air. Tonight, we'll share some of their comments with those of you who may not have sampled the conversation online. Here, WBUR's Sean Cole and Micheline Boudreau read from listeners writing about the news that emerged earlier this week that some Pentagon officials had found themselves surprised at the resolve of the Taliban forces.
Listener Zvonky writes, "Are military and political leaders trying to pull the wool over our eyes when they claim they are surprised at how tough the Taliban is to root out and destroy? Either that or worse, are they profoundly and dangerously ignorant? As we know, Afghanistan has a long history of resisting outside forces, going back to Alexander the Great. I'm certainly not surprised at all that the Taliban remains dug in and defiant. Perhaps U.S. leaders are performing an exercise in spin control and not stupidity when they say they are surprised by the Taliban's strength. But looking at all the missteps by the Bush administration so far, particularly on the domestic front, I'm not so sure."
Listener Ted B. writes, "I don't think the military or the administration is surprised at all. The press has made it seem like the bombing was going to crush them, but if you listen to what the military brass and strategists have said from the beginning, you get a more realistic picture. They keep saying over and over again that it will be a long war and not an easy one."
Listener Orion writes, "It strikes me that managing the diverse branches of the federal government in a crisis is a complex task, and the fact that there is some lack of coordination and communication is inevitable. Regarding the issue of surprise, would it make you feel better if the Pentagon official in question were less than candid? Christ, this is war, and it doesn't run like a train schedule. I think the Pentagon is aware of this fact, but when they speak openly of their impressions, they are critiqued by armchair generals who assume that things would be going better if they were running the show."
Listener El Chucko writes, "I'm glad you think the administration is above criticism. I have another, less confident opinion. They're human and make mistakes. The more they talk about being surprised, the more an account of an FBI agent on the radio after 9/11 haunts me. He said that trying to find someone in the mountains is nearly impossible. Example, the FBI searched one lousy mountain in Tennessee with 100 agents for 9 months for someone they knew was there. Never did find the guy. He made the point that the mountain was a little hill in comparison with the Afghan mountains. Did the administration know this? If their surprise is genuine, why didn't they know?"
Another discussion in the special coverage forums questions the warning issued by the Justice Department of a potential terrorist threat. A listener using the handle JubJub writes, "I am thinking of the last time we were warned, and that's about when anthrax started to pop up. We were never told what to be cautious of. Same thing this time. I think it's absurd that we keep getting warnings with no specific details."
Listener Secularist writes, "Agreed. It's astonishing that these leaders are so mindless or reckless as to assume that the content of their utterances doesn't matter. Even more astonishing if they believe that empty warnings will do some good."
Orion writes, "Secularist, I'm not a fan of John Ashcroft, but I think he believes that his mindless utterances serve to alert local law enforcement to be on a heightened state of alert as a result of a nonspecific threat that the government deems to be credible. The alternative to do nothing would expose them to charges of gross misconduct in the event that something did happen from people like you."
Listener Ted B. writes, "I agree with Orion. The alert was sent out to all state and local police. Therefore, if it were not mentioned to the public, even if no details were available, the press and others would eat the government for lunch if something happened. It's human nature to become less alert as time goes by. This helps us to get back up to full alertness."
Conversations from our online forums. You too can sound off on our forums. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Read the latest news from Arabic language satellite TV Al Jazeera. It's translated on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage, or join the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR, Boston.